Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, historian and author Deborah Cohen discusses her book, Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. Cohen is joined in conversation by Daniel Green, president and librarian at the Newberry Library. The following conversation originally took place at the American Writers Festival on May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name is Noelle Velasco, and I'm one of the program coordinators at the American Writers Museum. I'd like to welcome you all to this program at the American Writers Festival, celebrating the past, present, and future of American writing. Our first program today highlights the courageous reporters whose work illuminated the first half of the 20th century. Deborah Cohen's Last Call at the Hotel Imperial tells a story of four cub reporters working in Europe on the brink of the Second World War. Deborah Cohen is the Richard W. Leopold Professor at History at Northwestern University. Last Call at the Hotel Imperial is her fourth book. She's previously written about veterans, the British love affair with their possessions, and families and social stigma. She writes regularly for The Atlantic about subjects ranging from private lives to war photography to punk rock. She's interviewed today by Daniel Green, president and librarian of the Newberry Library. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, and thanks for being here. It's an honor to be part of this first go-around with the American Writers Museum Festival. Deborah, first, congratulations. What a book. It's really, it's an astounding read. So I highly recommend that all of you here should buy this and read it. You'll learn a lot. So you write about this inner circle of foreign correspondents during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. John Gunther, H.R. Knickerbocker, Jimmy Sheehan, Dorothy Thompson, and others. These were big names at the time, but they might not be as well known today. I'm just curious how you found your way to them and what made you want to dive so deep into their lives and their work.
So thank you so much, first of all, to the American Writers Museum and the American Writers Festival for having me. And I want also to thank all of the organizers, volunteers, and also Daniel Green for being here to talk with me. I really appreciate it. So my book is about a group of young men and women who in the early 20s set out for Europe and Asia from America. They would become the most famous international journalists of their day. And I'm just going to say a little bit about each one of them just to introduce them to you. John Gunther was a Chicagoan who worked for one of the city's big daily papers, the Chicago Daily News. And he essentially posted himself abroad for the CDN to Europe. He would have a huge success in 1936 with a book that derived from 12 years of European reporting, and that was his Inside Europe, published in 1936, a behind-the-scenes account of the dictators on the rise in the European continent. The second figure in my book is a man named Vincent or Jimmy Sheehan. He was born and raised in the mining town of Pena in downstate. And like John Gunther, he went to the University of Chicago. A decade out of Pena, Jimmy Sheehan was essentially embedded within the Bloomsbury group, so an incredible social mobility. He is reporting from every crisis spot in the 20s, from European, the rise of Italian fascism, to anti-colonial movements, fighting it out with their Spanish overlords in North Africa. And he writes an era-defining book entitled Personal History, which is published in 1935. The third figure is Dorothy Thompson, who amasses a string of firsts. She's the first American woman to run a major overseas news bureau in Berlin. She's the first American woman to have an op-ed column of her own in the late 1930s with an audience of 8 to 10 million thrice weekly. And she is the first American reporter to be kicked out of Nazi Germany in 1934. And the fourth figure is a Texan, a man named H.R. Knickerbocker, the highest paid foreign correspondent of his day. H.R. Knickerbocker was reportedly the only foreign correspondent whose dispatches Mussolini actually bothers to read all the way through. He is also, becomes the bête noire of Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister. So these four figures are all young journalists. They're in their 20s in the 1920s, 30s in the 1930s, and they follow two big stories. One of them is the rise of European dictatorship, and the second is the rise of anti-colonial nationalist movements across Asia.
So it's a new role at this time to be a foreign correspondent. I wonder if you could just kind of situate that for us. Why are newspapers doing that? What attracts Sheehan, Knickerbocker? You write, it's also interesting, I mean, you talk about them with their first names throughout the book, maybe you want to talk about that, and maybe we should use their first names, Dorothy and Jimmy and Nick. But what's going on in the environment of the media for newspapers to decide we need to have foreign correspondents stationed abroad?
So there had always been people who were sending dispatches from abroad, and there had always been war correspondents, you know, from the beginning of the modern newspaper in the 18th century. What happened in America after the First World War was a growing conviction on the part of newspaper owners and proprietors that Americans needed their own eyes and ears abroad, that they couldn't any longer rely on wire services or European newspapers, that Americans had been inveigled by the tricky British into the Great War, into the First World War, and that if that weren't going to happen again, that Americans needed to report the news for other Americans. So this is very much a moment when this group of young people, fiercely independent, irreverent, really the women are kind of wised up flappers and the young men are people who are sick and tired of American moralism. It's a moment when this group of people come to set the mold on what will become American foreign correspondence.
So they're great writers. Deborah also is a great writer. I think it takes a lot of guts to take on, in your own book, a book about great writers. But you write, theirs was the work of interpretation, of explaining why an event had happened and what it meant. You also say that taking sides morally was avoided, but the correspondents could, under certain limited conditions, offer his opinion. So I just wonder if you could tell us more about how they write, right? It's not op-eds, but it's not just the facts either.
That's right. So foreign correspondents, so people who'd been reporting abroad had always been given a little bit more latitude in terms of interpreting the news, because it was understood that their readers wouldn't actually be able to place the particular politicians or figures they were discussing. In this case, though, this group of young people had been brought up in city newspaper rooms of respectable papers, say the Chicago Daily News, where what was enshrined in them was the need to tell both sides, or what we would call objectivity. So they grow up as young people with the idea that they have to tell both sides, and then they get to Europe, and there's a problem, which is, how can you tell both sides when what you've just seen is a group of Jews dragged into brown houses and tortured? What's the other side? Or how do you tell both sides when you're there in 1934, in February of 1934 in Vienna, when the Austrian dictator Dollfuss starts to fire on his own people heavy munitions directed at socialist housing projects where there are not just men, but women and children as well? And slowly, and actually for some of them very agonizingly, that was certainly the case for John Gunther, they begin to surrender the idea of objectivity and to feel that they're not just witnesses, but that they have a responsibility to report the news in a way that Americans are going to understand the urgency of what they are seeing, and also understand that the United States cannot stand apart from the great world conflict that is brewing.
So do they talk to each other about this, about objectivity? And then, I guess, also, how do you, as a researcher, as a historian, figure out, I mean, you can read their columns, but so much of this book is also about their conversations with each other. How do you get at that?
Yeah, so they do talk to each other. They talk to each other and they argue with each other. So there's so many good questions in here. I'm going to sort of separate them out and take them one at a time. This group of reporters left extraordinary archives. So I have been, like Danny, I've been a historian for 30 years, 30 plus years, and I've worked in a lot of really rich archives. But this group of archives is beyond imagining because they're, it's precisely because they're reporters. They take notes, they sit down with, Hitler, they're taking notes. They sit down with their friends in a bar, they're taking notes afterwards. You have an affair with your best friend's wife, you run home and take notes on it. So the drive to self-documentation is not just a flood of correspondence and all of the documentation that surrounds their journalistic work, but it's also extensive diary keeping. And that diary keeping arises from a really fundamental conflict, I think, in them, which is that they're both people who were raised with a certain idea of Victorian rationalism. You know, they're all born around the turn of the 20th century when it's imagined that if you just try hard enough, you're going to be able to sort of understand where morally you're headed. And then they encounter Freud. And they begin to believe intellectually in the irrational, but they still feel that with enough effort, they can work out exactly why it is that they feel the way they do. And so you have these sprawling, enormous diary projects that are born out of the desire to apply rationality to things that they actually recognize are irrational. There are many, to return to the objectivity question, there are many conflicts that they document of arguing with each other late into the night. As I say in the book, I want the reader to actually feel and hear those conversations because for me, as a historian sitting in the archives, they were so vivid. So they're arguing, should the United States be in the war? When should the United States be in the war? How do you report something like the assault that the Austrian dictator Dollfuss makes on his population? I should add that there are the four principal reporters at the heart of the book, and then there's another one who is Frances Feinman Gunther, who marries John Gunther. And she is constantly taking her husband to task, not just because she feels that he's reporting the wrong thing, that he's too much of a Chicago American profile reporter. He's telling you what the man's mustaches looked like and what he ate for supper or what he ate for breakfast. And she wants her husband to take a much firmer stand and actually to engage what she views as the really crucial issues. One of them is Marxism, so economics, and the other one is Freud, psychoanalysis.
So it's interesting, too, as I was reading the book. So Deborah's written in the past also about family secrets, right, which is a different thing, difficult thing to get at in archives. And there's a lot of, well, I don't know, would the archive that they left us, would they think of what they're leaving as secrets, or would they want this to be public? I mean, you could imagine that some of this is so intimate, some of what's in their archive is so intimate that they would have said, you know, burn this upon my death, or burned it late in their life. I mean, so thank goodness they didn't. But do they not see what they're writing as secret?
It's such an important question. So part of their intellectual project and part of their group project as a group of friends is to destigmatize behaviors and kind of things that people have kept secret. And they do this in a variety of ways. One of them is that, as I said, they're very irreverent. This is the first modern sexual revolution, the revolution of the 1920s. So there is incredible amounts of drinking, there is adultery, there is sex, there's sex of every kind. They partake in all of that, and they come to see a connection between those people who are repressing those impulses and instincts and their own, you know, sort of selfhood, and the rise of fascism. So in other words, they believe, and this is especially true for John Gunther, that part of what is going wrong in the world is that people are so screwed up psychologically. So Inside Europe is an account of the things like the childhood of Hitler, Why does Hitler turn out to be such a maniac? Well, John Gunther goes and finds Hitler's relatives in the Austrian backwater to try to answer that question. So as Dorothy Thompson says in the 1950s, nothing that was human was foreign to us, meaning that what she believed was that everything should be known. They do not burn their archives or dispose of their archives. And John Gunther's second wife, who's just died in 2020, she also preserved the archive, which is at the University of Chicago Special Collections, 250 boxes of an archive. And I'm talking boxes, like big boxes, because they are engaged in an effort to destigmatize sex, death, illness. From this group come two really landmark taboo-breaking books. One of them is Death Be Not Proud, John Gunther's account of the death, the illness and death of his 17-year-old son, which is published in 1949. And that is viewed as such a shocking book for him to publish, such a private experience to put out there in public, that the press has really significant reservations about it. And then Jimmy Sheehan publishes in the early 1960s the account of Dorothy Thompson's marriage, second marriage with Sinclair Lewis, the writer Sinclair Lewis, which is sort of an unmitigated disaster for all parties. And again, a book that's viewed as the frankest marriage, the account of a marriage ever published, and quite a shocking book for its moment.
I want to get to Inside Europe, but maybe first, just to keep it chronological. So you mentioned that Dorothy Thompson is the first American journalist who gets kicked out of Nazi Germany. Maybe tell us a little bit about her interview with Hitler, and because the interview with Hitler is 1931, before he is the chancellor, and then she's kicked out in 1934. So what's going on in that time? Why are the Nazis paying so much attention to her that they would expel her as a foreign correspondent?
American foreign correspondents are hugely important for politicians, foreign politicians of every kind, because it's understood that they are a very small number of people who are funneling the news to millions of others in America. Dorothy Thompson has tried to get an interview with Hitler all through the 1920s after the Beer Hall Putsch, and she finally manages it in 1931. And she sees him, and she makes what is for her an uncharacteristic mistake. Dorothy Thompson is one of the smartest commentators on European affairs, bar none. But like millions of other people, she underestimates Hitler. She sees him, she says, "I thought I would be really scared. I thought I would be very intimidated. But within a minute of sitting down with him, I realized his startling insignificance." And then she says, a dig at his masculinity, "I bet he's a man who crooks his little finger when he sips his tea." And she essentially says, look, Hitler's not going to amount to anything. How could this Austrian house painter be a person of any kind of consequence in the land of Goethe and Thomas Mann and Albert Einstein? This is not possible. And as her friends later rib her for her comico-terrible gaffe, one of the things that happens as a consequence of that 1931 interview is that Hitler, who is really reluctant to see the foreign press himself because he doesn't really like interviews, he likes talking to millions of people, right? He likes over the radio or to thousands in the stadium. He has Dorothy Thompson in his sights. And so when the Nazis come to power, she writes a set of reports for the Jewish wire services about atrocities against Jews immediately after the Nazi takeover. And by the time she comes back to Germany in 1934, there's already an order of expulsion.
So when she gets back to the United States, too, I've seen that there's great newsreel footage when she arrives in the United States. You know, people are waiting on the docks to interview her. But it's interesting, she actually frames it. She doesn't talk about herself. She talks about democracy, freedom of the press, freedom of speech. Is that representative of you know, as these foreign correspondents thought about their significance in the world, were they framing our understanding of democracy at a time where they were seeing, I mean, they're all over the world too, right? They're in Ethiopia, right? They're in Spain, all these places where democracy is under threat. How are they thinking about democracy and freedom of speech and their role within that?
For all of them, it is crucial. So they're of different political stripes. I would say Dorothy Thompson and H.R. Knickerbocker are the most conservative of them, and Vincent Sheehan, who's always in a kind of flirtation with communism, is, you know, on the left-hand side, and Francis Gunther still further to the left. They see themselves as defenders, as bulwarks of liberty. They have watched. They watch the European press become extinguished in all of the fascist countries from which they're reporting. So literally, they are the people who are conveying the news out of those countries, and then it's being re-imported, of course, back into those countries through their work, among other things. So Dorothy Thompson, when she's expelled from Germany, she both has a very good sense of how to turn this into a publicity triumph for herself and to really make herself part of the news story. But as Danny says, she's also very clever in how she frames it, which is to call attention to the first, what she and John Gunther say, this is the first thing that dictators have to do. They have to crush the press. And you can crush me, you can kick me out, but there will be another foreign correspondent who's going to come and is watching you.
So January 1936 is a really important moment in your book when Inside Europe comes out. I wonder if you can just kind of set the stage, tell everyone what this book is about, and then you say, I think you say it's an unabashedly American book. So what does that mean?
So Inside Europe, John Gunther had, as a young man, had wanted to be a novelist. So he'd written a bunch of unsuccessful novels and short stories. And Inside Europe was commissioned by Cass Canfield at Harper's. He was looking for someone to write a survey of what was happening in Europe. And Gunther started this book. He had to be persuaded to write it. He got a huge advance at the time to write it. Cass Canfield actually wanted H.R. Knickerbocker to write it, but he said, I'm too busy. The only guy who can write this is John Gunther. Gunther starts the book with the idea that what he's going to do is report all the stories that you will hear if you are a reporter sitting in the reporter's bars, all the behind-the-scenes news, all of the gossip, all of the scandal, all of what's really going on with the personalities behind the news, and that he's going to publish it. Now, at first he thinks he can't actually attach his name to it because it's going to be such a scandalous book, and it's viewed as being a hugely American book because of the interest in personalities, because of the sense that here is an irreverent outsider who is taking on the, you know, pieties, the established orthodoxies of politics and the way in which you should actually write, you know, with some kind of dignity about world leaders. Instead, he's writing about Hitler, Mussolini, and all of the little kind of tin pot European, East European dictators as being gangsters. He, as I said before, he goes and he finds Hitler's relatives in this Austrian backwater village. He goes and he collects the latest scoop on Ataturk's venereal disease. He is essentially retailing a lot of what counts as the unpublishable newspaper material. And the attempt is, he puts it right there on the first page. He says, conflicts, unresolved conflicts and repressions in the lives of various European politicians will cause the end of our civilization. This is crucial to know.
So you have to tell everyone too about Francis Feynman Gunther as well, because really one of the things that we learn and that's so gripping in this book is about their relationship both personally and professionally. She's part of Inside Europe too, isn't she? But certainly not, maybe not remembered until you've kind of recovered that history for us.
Yeah, so Frances Feynman Gunther was herself, as I said, a sometimes foreign correspondent. She reported, among other places, for the London News Chronicle. She was a young woman who, she was Jewish. She had gone to Barnard, to Rice, to Radcliffe, claiming that she'd gotten kicked out of all of them. She did get kicked out of two of the three, but probably not Radcliffe. It made a better story. She was an extraordinarily smart and theoretical thinker. very up to date on all of the latest kind of conceptual ways in which people in the 1920s were thinking about society and economics. She fell in love with John Gunther in the 20s when they crossed paths in Paris. And from the very beginning, the dynamic was that here was a young man who could write like an angel. He could describe things so that you felt like they were just right there. You were right there in the street seeing them with him. But as his wife, Frances, said, he couldn't think. Now, this was an overstatement. Of course, he could think. I mean, what does that even mean? But what she meant was that he was not a theoretical deep thinker. And in fact, he begins to take on her critique and think, I actually am not a theoretical person. And he becomes ever more dependent, as he says, on Frances to do his thinking for him. So they evolve a relationship where she has great trouble writing. She has a tremendous case of writer's block. So she's funneling him her best ideas, and they end up in his book, and sometimes he gives her credit. So she is on throughout inside Europe, as Frances Feynman Gunther says, or as Frances Gunther has remarked. But that kind of dynamic in a writer's marriage is just, you know, obviously it's not going to end happily. And these are stories that we know from other Lost Generation writerly couples like F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. So in part, the book is about a group of friends, and it's also a book that's about marriage and about the difficulties of marriage, of competition, of living amidst this sexual revolution and how you should behave, of how you parent your children. And the reason it's about both private life and also about their work is that they are constantly making those connections for themselves. So Frances Gunther is asking herself, how is a marriage like an empire? So how is my marriage like the British Empire? And it seems like a ridiculous question on the face of it, but really what she's getting at is how does domination and subordination work in a marriage? What resources belong to the Indian people, and what resources are the British entitled to? What of my own intellectual capital belongs to me, and what should I give to my husband? So that kind of slippage between inner life and geopolitics is totally characteristic, not just of this group of people, but I think of many, many other people in the 1930s.
Well, and some of the last portions of the book also really look at John and Frances Gunther as parents, too, in a deeply emotional story around the sickness of their son. I wonder, that actually takes up kind of a lot of real estate in your book, and I wonder, I think you should tell that story, but also, why did it become so important to the book as a whole? You really go deep on their son's illness.
So this is the book, Death Be Not Proud, published in 1949, is the book of John Gunther's that's been continuously in print. It's the only book of his that's been continuously in print. As I said, it was a taboo-breaking book, like Inside Europe, and for some of the same reasons, which is that he was bringing to public view the most painful and shocking set of circumstances, which was the diagnosis of his then 16-year-old son, Johnny, with a brain tumor, in 1946. So John Gunther at this point is writing Inside USA, which is going to be one of his really biggest books. And he gets a call from Deerfield Academy, which is where Johnny is a student. He and Frances then try everything that could be tried. They consult scores of doctors. They try every sort of treatment that is available. And Johnny dies in the summer of 1947. So the reason this is such a hugely important event, for the Gunthers is probably obvious. I mean, this is the thing that is transformative in lots of ways for both of their lives, as it would be for any parent. Where it's important for the book is this is the turn in the book when we go from a group of people whose experiences of what matters are forged in the 1930s, and to go back to Danny's point about democracy, one of the things that they share as a common value, this group of friends, is also a belief in the sanctity of the individual, which is they have watched a world be taken over from left and for right by people who don't believe in the individual, for whom an individual life doesn't matter. Death Be Not Proud is an attempt to reclaim this importance of the individual. This is something that they're all doing in various ways. This is John Gunther's way. And what he's saying is, I'm going to show you. 70 million people have died in the first half of the 20th century, but I'm going to show you why a single individual life matters, and the possibilities of that life, and the reason why it matters that it was extinguished, and why we should care. So that's for me, what you can see with that book is that he opens up the floodgates. So this is the first modern memoir of illness and death. This entire genre that we now have, which is the grief memoir, starts there at Death Be Not Proud. And he receives thousands of letters from people who write to him to say, thank you for giving voice to my experience. And that was whether their children died, their sons were soldiers who died at Guadalcanal, whether they are talking about another bereavement, that there's a ways in which he opens up a space for mourning. And I say he, but of course I should properly say they, because the book is based upon Francis's notes taken during Johnny's illness. And the book also includes an aftermath, sort of a note from Francis at the end of it. And since I've talked about the Gunthers' competitiveness and their jealousies, especially Francis's jealousies, of what John writes, it's significant that this book they always refer to as the Johnny book, meaning that it's their son's book, it's neither of theirs.
Well, and Johnny's voice is, Johnny's voice stuck with me after reading this as well. We have time for a couple more questions, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So it probably will not surprise any of you then that these writers think about their legacy, right? So you talk about that. By 1944, you explain that Jimmy Sheehan was worrying about his time as a reporter was done. And you write, the good news, their style of reporting, Jimmy called it a school, would endure. So is he right on either count? Was their time done? And does their style of reporting and writing endure?
So I think yes and yes. He was right in the sense that their zeitgeist was the zeitgeist of the 30s and 40s. So they continue on. John Gunther continues to sell millions of books. As Sheehan himself has various successes, writerly successes. Dorothy Thompson still has a column. But the moment in which, the era in which they are going to be the signal voices is done. And actually, this exchange happens at a stork club between Jimmy Sheehan and John Gunther. And Jimmy says, we're done. And John Gunther thinks, well, baby, you're done. I'm not done, which he writes in his diary. Their legacy endures through, probably most obviously, through the new journalism of the 1960s. So what we think about is fly on the wall, Gay Talese, Joan Didion even, a kind of subjective putting yourself into the story. Now, the new journalists never acknowledge the pedigree, so they don't go back and say, well, yes, indeed, it all began with Jimmy Sheehan. But personal history, Sheehan's personal history, 1935, really institutes or inaugurates the significance, or as someone says about this book, who writes a foreword, that what really mattered was what the reporter thought.
I'm gonna just ask one more question. And so Deborah fast forwards at the end of her book to 1971 with, I think, this big wink to your readers. So it's 1971 and someone's seeking to write a biography of Dorothy Thompson and is going to meet with Jimmy Sheehan, who's still around in 1971. So he meets this writer, Jimmy Sheehan meets this writer who's seeking to write a biography of Dorothy Thompson, and I think it's fair to say he thinks she's an idiot, right? So you write, the woman had done plenty of research about Dorothy Thompson. She could tell you who Dorothy had an affair with in 1923, as if that mattered. And she had spotted every piddling flaw in her subject's character. But as for the truth about Dorothy, she hadn't the beginning of a clue. So here you are, writing this collective biography about Dorothy Thompson, Nick, Jimmy Sheehan, and John Gunther, and you've told us about their affairs, and you've told us about their work. So it struck me as a lot of courage there for you to kind of close that way. But what are you ultimately trying to leave the reader with in telling that story?
Thank you, first of all, for noting that. It's a wink. It is a wink. And what I'm saying is the thing that Sheehan and Gunther, who are busy, you know, writing books about other people that they don't like, usually autobiographical things, and Sheehan especially in Personal History, makes a lot of enemies with that book because people feel that their own, you know, personal information has been disclosed. But the part of it that's the wink is that anyone who does any kind of biographical project knows that you only get so close, that you read things through, you know, your own set of interests. And rather than saying all that, which has become sometimes obligatory for biographers to say, what I wanted to say was these people perfectly well knew the ways in which they would be interpreted, reinterpreted, misunderstood, and that is inherent to the exercise. So, and I wanted to give you a little glimpse forward in 1971 as Sheehan is, he's old, he's sick, he's infuriated by the chutzpah of these people who think that they can write about his friend. They know nothing about his friend. And of course, we can only get so close.
Well, it's a wonderful way to close, and your voice comes through so strongly at that point. Also, it feels like such an intimate book and such a critically important book in shaping. These are the people who shaped how Americans understood the world at their moment. So we're happy to take questions if anyone wants to step up to the. Would you mind stepping up to the microphone to ask the question? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This was terrific. So you picked 4+ journalists, and they're the subject of your book, and you've talked a bit about how they're sort of a precursor to new journalism. Could you spread your view out a little bit and just talk about journalism in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and how these characters were maybe different or brought forth, you know, new tendencies in journalism, or to what extent journalism was also moving with these characters? Thank you.
Yes, I think that that's a very important point. I mean, so choosing which journalists to write about was complicated. I mean, what I wanted was a group of friends, but even within that, there's a sort of inner circle of the book and there's an outer circle of the book. And in the outer circle of the book are people who were also hugely important journalists of their moment, like Bill Shire or Emily Hahn. Journalism is moving in the 30s towards, as Dorothy Thompson says, becoming the representative form of American life. And so there are ways in which the kinds of subjectivity that comes to infuse their work is evident more broadly. So subjectivity and objectivity more generally, not just in their work, are battling it out especially in the 1930s. The personality-driven nature of journalism is also becoming more pronounced with the advent of the tabloids, which is another. Jimmy Sheehan actually works for the New York Daily News, which is where he gets his, you know, kind of flair. And a lot of the subjects that John Gunther deals with, people feel like, well, that's appropriate for the tabloid. There are also major questions about the social function of journalism that not just journalists are asking, but people like the Chicago School thinkers, so sociologists, philosophers, political scientists are asking about the significance of newspapers to democracy and what kind of democracy you're going to have if all people can read are tabloids, or put it differently, what kind of democracy you're going to have if people get their news from TikTok. So there's, as you say, there's a much broader context about the changing media landscape here. And, you know, there are subjects like the dominance of press barons, of respectable papers like the Times or the Chicago Daily News that are trying to battle about the ways in which Hearst, et cetera, are hugely important in the kind of news that people get. Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
I was listening. You covered cover such a large area of history. How do we, as a future journalism or writer, hold the person who picks up that book so they don't start wandering and go, okay, this is too much like a history book? I heard you mention about Adolf Hitler. Most people would turn and go, we don't want to read about him.
Yeah.
So I heard you mention about a romance, but one thing I didn't hear, and I'm going to say, how did that impact on the writer as they were in Europe during the time of World War II, 45, and then when they came back to the States, I'm assuming they came back in 71 here, because there was so much going on here. Is any of that incorporated into this book?
It's a very good question. So one of the issues is when you're dealing with a handful of people and, you know, a space of time in which, just like our time now, there's a sense of compression. So here, 1935, the Italian invasion of Abyssinia. Then 1936, the Spanish Civil War starts, and on and on and on. So the book really is about the 20s and the 30s, and a little bit about the Second World War. But these people's time, you know, they were not the war reporters of their moment. H.R. Knickerbocker was probably the most significant of them. During the war, what it's about is people who sounded the alarm on the rise of fascism, who called attention to the rise of anti-colonial nationalism. And so what Danny is describing, which is, I stop, right? I think their moment is basically done. That's part of, I agree with Sheehan. And then I pick back up again in 1971 as a kind of coda, an epilogue, to make you realize, of course, they continue living, most of them, and they're engaged, as people are, in a reevaluation of their legacy. And everything that looks appropriate in their moment, like the emotionalism of their reporting, looks completely different in the 1950s. It looks excessive, over the top. What are these people doing? What are, you know, why should we still listen to them? But I wanted to give you that glimpse of the very end of the story, because there's a way in which, if you're not going to write a soup to nuts biography, which I wasn't going to, I had too many people to do that, I still wanted to give you a sense of, like, what does the life look like? Because those reflective moments at the end of life are some of the most interesting moments in a person's life.
But you also, I think, when you think about here we are at a writer's festival, and when you think about yourself as a writer, this book is so grounded in specific moments, right? It's not in platitudes about democracy or the role of journalists in the world, which, you know, you could have taken it that way. But really what you do is tell great stories, right? And I imagine, and there are great stories where it seems like you're trusting your reader, right, to understand. You help a great deal, but you trust your reader to understand the impact of those stories. And it struck me also that, I mean, there must be obviously so much you know about these people that's not in these pages, and so much that ended up on the cutting room floor, which is so hard to do as a writer, but I think so benefits the book, right? I guess just maybe we can close with, you've written four books now, and what did you learn about yourself as a writer in doing this one?
That is a very good question. So part of the answer is, and I see various people who knew this firsthand or were firsthand observers of this horrible process. I mean, I threw away 70,000 words, so several hundred pages of the book in a false start at the very beginning. So I wrote it. I wrote a big bunch, and then it was too close to the people's account. I wanted, my first idea was that I wanted you to be able to hear their voices, and I didn't want to be in the book at all, not as a distant third narrator, not as a historian, not as an anything. I I wanted you to be learning about their world as they learned about their world from them. And that was just too hard. I mean, I'm sure that there are writers who could do it, but I couldn't do it in any way that was intelligible to a reader. So I threw that all away and started again. And because I was working with so many people, I thought about it in terms of scenes. So what are the important things where there's so much, there's a density of the archival material, and then there's so much that you need to know. So there has to be a scene in the Italians are invading Ethiopia in 1935, and who's there but H.R. Knickerbocker, along with Yves Lanois. There has to be Dorothy Thompson interviewing Hitler. And so stitching it together in that way also was important to me, that you go backwards and forwards between them, because it's precisely the dynamism of their friendships, of their rivalries, of their hatreds, actually, because this is a book fundamentally about a group of people, some of whom really come to dislike each other intensely. And it was important to me that you have that sense of hearing them and then hearing another account of the same event and circling back. So.
Well, Deborah, it's a challenging book. It's an emotional book. It's a beautiful book. So thank you for writing it. Thanks for being here today, and thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the interview, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr. discusses his book, A Few Days Full of Trouble, Revelations on the Journey to Justice for My Cousin and Best Friend, Emmett Till. Reverend Parker is joined by co-author Christopher Benson. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.